Members, I will call the meeting to order of the Energy Policy Committee. We have a few bills up on the schedule today. Representative Atkins was going to go first. He's not here, so the chair is going to take her prerogative to put herself first. So, Representative Portman, welcome to your committee, and would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. Members, I'd like to move House File 956, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Energy Omnibus Bill.
All right. Representative Portman, do you have an author's amendment to 956?
I do. I have the DE1, and I would offer that to get the bill in the shape I would like it to be.
We'll put the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion passes. The amendment prevails. Let's move on then. Representative Portman, the amendment is adopted. Why don't you talk to us about your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 956 is the governor's energy policy bill, and I am carrying it as a courtesy to the governor, but also because I believe a lot in the work that the governor is supporting in the bill and the work that Bill Grant has done to bring together stakeholders and move Minnesota's energy policy forward. There are a lot of big changes in the bill, significant progress for the state of Minnesota in the area of energy policy and dealing with the issues of distributed generation and solar. And I have Bill Grant from the Department of Commerce to walk through the bill.
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman, members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. As Representative Portman notes, this bill is the product of 18 months worth of conversations with stakeholders around the whole issue of distributed generation. One of the things that we realized after this administration took over and we started looking at where there were energy policy gaps that could be filled, one of the things we learned was that our net metering policy, our policy toward distributed generation, was some 30 years old, and that of the 44 states that have net metering policies in place, that we were number 44 in terms of the amount of capacity that had been added from net metered facilities over that 30-year period. We at the department, and I think utilities around the state are experiencing this too, a fair amount of demand, a growing demand from consumers who want to be able to generate their own electricity for their own use in their homes and businesses. And yet state policy seems to be something of a barrier to that at this point. And thus, Mr. Chairman, House File 956. So I'll do a quick walkthrough of the bill, and then we do have one witness that we'd like to bring up to discuss a particular section of the bill that I think members will find of particular interest. So starting from the top, Section 1 of the bill, the language on lines 2.2 to 2.5, address the issue that in investor-owned service territories, it's not possible at this point to conduct what are called third-party financing arrangements for solar electricity from a group of consumers who could be aggregated to find a site for solar that's better than they might have on their own homes or businesses. So this language simply removes a current restriction to that that prevents more than 25 customers from being aggregated before they'd be qualified as a public utility. So we create an exemption for that purpose. Section 2 of the bill is the definition section, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about that when members have questions. Section 3 is where we transition the current net metering program from being capped at 40 kilowatts to 1 megawatt. And the reason for that is that as time has gone on and as larger and larger customers, particularly small to medium-sized businesses, have wanted to invest in renewable technologies, the 40 kilowatt cap has been a real barrier to that. So the 1 megawatt reflects the more average system size, particularly in the commercial and small business sectors that we're seeing today. It's also about average for those states that have net metering policies. Moving along to Section 4 of the bill, This essentially is conforming language, to move the cap from 40 kilowatts to 1 megawatt. I should point out that on line 3.22, the new language there is to make it clear that we're grandfathering those customers who are currently on net metering and receiving the average retail rate for their excess generation. Later in the language, you'll note that for new customers, we're transitioning those customers to the avoided cost rate, which is substantially lower. The reason for that is that it's our feeling that net metering was never intended as a revenue generation source for homeowners and businesses, nor as a way to generate excess electricity, but was really intended to afford customers the opportunity to generate electricity for their own use. So that's Section 3, Section 4. Section 5 of the bill is allowing customers to receive the rate that we're talking about, the avoided cost rate, once we reach that point, and I believe we have that set at January 1st, 2015. Section 6 of the bill deals with meter aggregation. Right now, net metering policy restricts a customer to one meter on their property for the purpose of determining how much net metering they can do. A number of farmers have multiple meters on their properties, one at the house, one at the barn, and this would allow them to aggregate all of the usage on those meters for the purpose of net metering. Section 7 of the bill is a way for us to make sure that if we're really going to grow the amount of distributed generation that we have on the system, that we check in at a reasonable point in time to make sure that we haven't impacted utility rates or reliability of utility systems negatively, and we've set that level at 5% of a utility's average system requirements. Given where we are today, most utilities are a long way from reaching that particular threshold, but we do think it's appropriate to have a point in time when we do check in to make sure that we're not exceeding a level that would start to impact non-participating ratepayers. This allows the utilities, in the case of an investor-owned utility, the Public Utilities Commission, or in the case of a municipal or cooperative utility, their local governing body, to make that determination whether 5% should be a cap or whether or not it makes sense to proceed beyond the 5% level. Section 8 of the bill is really more conforming language. It does, however, on line 7.1, make it clear that we're going to apply the same policy with respect to standby rates for 1 megawatt that we do at 40 kilowatts. That is, that we wouldn't allow utilities to charge standby rates while they're net metering. And just for the committee's information, a standby rate is basically a rate a utility charges to cover the fixed costs of serving a customer who is reducing their usage but remaining because they're generating their own electricity but wanting to remain on the system because they need to receive 24/7 electricity service. However, the standby rates that are currently being charged are often a significant barrier to customers deciding to use distributed generation technologies. Section 10 of the bill, or 9 of the bill, rather, is the value of solar section, and you're going to receive more testimony about this particular provision in a moment from Carl Robigo from the Austin, Texas Municipal Utility, or at least formerly of the Austin, Texas utility. The purpose behind this is to create an alternative path for utilities wanting to make distributed generation an option for their customers, but an option from traditional net metering. And basically, this is rather than just simply saying that the value of solar is whatever the utility's average retail rate is, instead, this will be a rate that's computed based on known and measurable values to the utility, things like the value of the energy, the value of the capacity, the value of avoiding transmission to the extent that solar has that impact, and stacking those values to create a rate that would be paid to consumers instead of allowing them to practice traditional net metering. We think this approach has some interesting advantages over traditional net metering, and we have heard much the same from many of the utilities. They particularly like the language, I think, on line 7.21 through 7.24, and many of you have probably heard about the concept of buy all, sell all. This is buy all, sell all. In other words, the customer continues to pay the utility for all of the energy that they've used on their premises as if they weren't generating their own electricity, and then in a second move receive compensation from the utility for every kilowatt hour that they generate from a solar system. This avoids some of the issues that are created by traditional net metering, and we think it's an attractive option that many utilities will want to consider. Section 10 of the bill is our solar electricity standard. It is very much patterned after the renewable energy standard language that's already in place. I'll point out a couple of things about it. One, you'll note right away that we haven't included any numbers in our standard.
Wise move, apparently, Mr. Grant.
We think that it's appropriate, Mr. Chairman, since we're talking about all of these issues with all the stakeholders, to arrive at a value in a stakeholder-driven fashion, similar to the way we resolve many of our issues here in Minnesota. The other thing I'll point out is that the language on beginning on line 9.13 to 9.18, this allows either the Public Utilities Commission or the company's, the utility's governing body, to determine whether or not at any point the standard is imposing excessive costs or reliability issues to that particular utility. And this is similar to language that we have in the current RES. We think it's even though no utilities have requested to use the so-called off-ramps, we think it's an important consumer protection to have in the language. Apart from that, Mr. Chairman, the rest of the language is as the current renewable energy standard is structured. Be happy to take any questions unless you'd like to go to our other witness first.
Mr. Grant, there is a question from a member, but I think Representative Quam, if we could go to Mr. Robigo first to talk more about value of solar, and then we'll move on to member questions. Mr. Robigo, welcome to the committee, and we're glad we could arrange a state tournament snowstorm for you.
Thank you. I haven't been in Minnesota much, but it seems to be cold every time I'm here. I don't know what that's about.
Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony,
sir. My name is Carl Robigo. I'm a principal of a consulting firm called Robigo Energy. I'm here as a consultant retained by the Department of Commerce's Division of Energy Resources. I live in Austin, Texas. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Portman and members of the committee and others here for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to speak and address these issues. I'm going to go through a couple of things pretty quickly here. First, I want to introduce you to the value of solar concept. Well, introduce you a little bit to me, then to the value of solar concept, a rate design for distributed residential solar as used in Austin, but distributed solar in general that I developed while working as Vice President for Distributed Energy Resources at Austin Energy, which is the municipal electric utility for the city of Austin, Texas. I want to stress, as Bill mentioned already, that I am no longer employed at Austin Energy. The rate is in effect there at the utility. We put it into effect shortly before I left. So I'm going to introduce myself, introduce the utility, and then, of course, stand for any questions that you may have. Again, my thanks to you for taking up these important issues related to electric utility service and distributed energy. As for me, I've spent more than 23 years in and around the electric utility industry. I've worked with utilities, regulators, government officials, and stakeholders in about six continents. Most of that work has been in regulatory and clean energy issues. My career highlights include, as I mentioned, time as a utility executive at Austin Energy, the eighth largest municipal electric utility company in the country, but also with the AES Corporation, a U.S. power company with operations in more than two dozen countries. I have been a public utility commissioner for the state of Texas, and I was a deputy assistant secretary at the U.S. Department of Energy in Washington, D.C. I've had several other positions in the public and private sector as well. I'm an attorney by training, and in fact, I was first introduced to the electric utility industry while I was pursuing a postdoctorate degree in environmental law and teaching while I was in the Army at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, New York. I've been involved in hundreds of regulatory proceedings and testified and worked with many legislative policy and business issues, local, state, and national levels. I'd now like to turn to my brief introduction of the value of solar rate. It was while I was at Austin Energy that I had a chance to develop a new alternative to net energy metering, or net metering, for distributed solar. The new value of solar rate, as I said, is in effect and is the subject of ongoing, or in Austin, Texas, at Austin Energy, and is also the subject of ongoing discussions in several other jurisdictions with different kinds of utilities as well. The distributed solar market segment is growing rapidly, as Mr. Grant said. Prices are falling, technology is improving, business supply chains are maturing, customer demand is also growing. Distributed solar generation is a good thing for many reasons. It is generation located very near the load. It can improve the security and resiliency of the grid as well as system load factor. It reduces strain on and extends the life of transmission and distribution assets. It is environmentally cleaner. It generates more jobs, especially local jobs, than conventional energy. It is easy to site. It is extremely reliable and highly available. It operates most near the time of summer peaks, and a substantial portion of the investment is paid for by private citizens. Of course, the solar fuel price never varies. These and other benefits of distributed solar are the reasons why Minnesota and the majority of states offer and require some form of net metering or net energy metering. Net metering accomplishes, as Mr. Grant said, a sort of rough justice for distributed solar, because it says solar generation, at least up to the point of the customer's consumption, is worth the same as the retail rate for electricity, because back when it first started, literally, solar generation made the meter spin backwards. So it was just a simple offset, one for one. And I say rough justice because it assigns that retail rate without really undertaking any calculation. There's no calculation embedded in the applicable underlying rate or in the assignment of that rate to solar generation to say what is solar worth. And that's what we were trying to get at with the value of solar. I'll talk about more in a minute. But net metering is administratively simple. Utilities have an easy time dealing with it because it looks exactly like the process under the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act of 1978 for qualified independent generator facilities. And today, however, we know as a result of more than a dozen studies from around the country that distributed solar is worth even more than the average price of energy. Now, Minnesota has a net metering law, as you well know, and you should be proud of it. It merits some improvements. But by and large, with those improvements, it could form a solid foundation for, I think, what could be a strong distributed energy sector in the state of Minnesota. At Austin Energy, we also offered net energy metering for distributed solar customers, and they still do for commercial customers. but we adopted a new value of solar rate as an alternative and improvement to net metering for our residential customers. The reasons for this change were several. The market conditions that I previously described, as well as the success of policy and rate initiatives, made it clear that distributed solar was poised for growth. With that growth came the realization that one day, customer-side solar could pose a revenue problem for the utility. Now, even though that day is a long ways away, even for Austin Energy, there were some that criticized solar net metering as creating inappropriate subsidies. Now, while that allegation is wrong on the facts, it is a very real issue of perception. In addition, our residential solar net metering system actually created an incentive for customers to use more energy. And finally, because net metering undercompensates for the real value of distributed solar, and because of growing demand, we were facing increasing pressure, real pressure, on our rebate and incentive programs. The value of solar rate is an approach that simply and elegantly addresses these and other issues facing utilities seeing growth in distributed solar in their service territory. It is the first solar rate designed by a utility seeking to support solar, but in a way that is fair to both solar and non-solar customers and to the utility itself. The switch from traditional net metering to the value of solar is simple because it really is just another kind of net process or netting process. It is one, however, that expressly recognizes that a solar customer is both using and supplying energy. The rate change involves only two steps. First, you use an analytical process with real and specific utility numbers to calculate exactly what distributed solar energy is worth to the utility. We wanted to know the rate at which the utility could either credit the customer for the solar generation or make it and sell it ourselves to that same customer. Fortunately, we had a value of solar calculator in place at Austin Energy. We had developed it some 6 years prior, an analytical spreadsheet tool. We had developed it originally so that we could evaluate proposals of solar generation from independent power producers. The model accounts for, as Mr. Grant stated, the price of utility conventional energy and capacity for fuel, for transmission and distribution costs and savings, for line losses, those heat losses that can result in 6 to 8% of the energy from a remote power plant being lost, and for the environmental benefits of clean local generation. We also studied some of the softer benefits, such as job creation and economic development value, but we did not feel sufficiently comfortable to include those in the solar value of solar rate that we ultimately adopted. So that calculated value of solar credit, we concluded, was the fair value for every kilowatt hour of solar generation, regardless of whether it was consumed on site or was excess and therefore available to serve another customer. And we set up a system where we would reset the number every year and thereby made sure that the utility was never overcompensating or undercompensating for solar generation. So change number one is that solar energy should be fairly compensated. Change number two is that we decided the utility should also be fairly compensated for the service that it provides to a solar customer. So while we still net, in Austin Energy, they still net the solar generation and the customer consumption, they do so at two different rates. And instead of doing it at the meter, as I described before, they do it on the bill. So sometimes it's also been called net billing. Solar customers are charged their appropriate rate for their total consumption as if they had no solar at all. This eliminates any reasonable argument of cross-subsidy and does away with complex and typically inaccurate attempts to calculate standby or partial requirements tariffs for customers. So, after charging the customer for gross consumption at their otherwise applicable rate, the bill, the utility bill, then provides a credit at the value of solar level for the energy made by the solar system. These simple changes have profound effects. They start encouraging energy efficiency by the customer and make more of that valuable on-peak energy available to the utility from solar systems. These changes reduce pressures on rebates. Austin Energy was able to lower its solar rebates by 20% just on the demand that was created when the value of solar rate was adopted. And the changes do improve the simple payback for solar, but because the calculations rely on the utility's own number and are annually updated, they never create an unjustified windfall for solar customers. In closing, I want to stress for you that there's nothing unique about Austin Energy or Texas. If I stopped there, that'd probably be a good way to talk. Or public power utilities that prevents the application of the value of solar rate to your electric service providers. So I believe it could offer some of these same benefits here in Minnesota. I encourage your favorable consideration of this approach that's laid out in the bill as an alternative to traditional net metering here in Minnesota. And I'd be glad to stand for any of your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Robigo. Mr. Grant, any other final comments before we go to questions from members?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I had a informational clarification from Mr. Grant. In Section 5, Sub D 4A, that's 4.33, 4.34, that versus Section 9, Sub D 10, C.5, lines 7.29, 7.30. There seems to be some conflicting in that the first section allows the customer to define the month, whereas in Section 9, it would default to a specific month. Which would it be?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, the first change that you noted is with respect to to net metering. The other would be with respect to the value of solar alternative. So that would be what would apply if the utility chose the value of solar alternative.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, since net you'd be using the metering, you'd be selling it back. I think that there I would see some conflict in that. It'd be nice to have one uniform way of defining the month. And I don't have a problem with the initial month, but then after you have an instance of where it's obvious that there's a generation, then put it onto to a schedule. And then Mr. Chair, and since we've got several bills we're going to be hearing along the same line of I'm hoping that one round of answering and clarifying these questions will be sufficient, so I won't be speaking later on these same questions. But what is the average consumption of a household? So we're going from 40 kilowatts to 1 meg. I'm trying to understand what's the scaling of that.
Sure.
For residential versus business.
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, most residential customers will be well below 40 kilowatts in their average usage. This is really intended to make these opportunities available to small business customers in addition to residential customers.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. That does help clarify the intent of the legislation. Now,
Representative Quam, we do have other members with questions. Can I move on and maybe come back to you so we can get others to get in there?
Is the gentleman
from Austin, Mr. Robigo? Yes?
Going to be available because there are specific questions on solar.
I'll come back to you, I promise, Representative Quam.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we have an integrated resource plan process here in the state of Minnesota, and it helps utilities choose generation based on need and cost and other factors. And can you tell me if there is a reason that this long-established program and process can't work for utilities to evaluate and possibly integrate solar?
Mr. Chairman Grant. And Representative Scott, I certainly do think that a good integrated resource planning process can identify opportunities for solar. Typically, though, utility planning won't be looking at small residential, small commercial scale generation projects in their planning process, at least not until those resources really get to scale. And so that's why there needs to be, I think, a separate process for identifying the solar resource at least at the distributed generation scale.
I would add,
Mr. Robigo.
Yes, you have a pretty powerful insight there in thinking about those, because it's the kind of valuation that goes into a value of solar calculation is very similar to the kind of resource evaluation process that a utility uses when it compares alternative resources for meeting long-term demand for energy services. So the calculation was very familiar to us at Austin Energy. The kinds of numbers were numbers that we produced for other purposes. It was just a matter of putting them into a spreadsheet model that churned out that levelized present value cost, that levelized present value of solar that was used as an indicative number. Same kind of approach that is often used in IRP processes. So there isn't a lot of learning that has to be done to step over to this.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the commissioner. This solar energy standard, I've noticed that you've left all the blanks open as far as percentages and stuff, and I just wondered if you could share with us the analysis that's going to be used to fill in the blanks there so that you can determine the optimum percentage of solar that you might be looking for.
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, I'm actually expecting that we're going to arrive at numbers to go into those slots through discussions with all of the stakeholders. The analysis is this, that each percentage point of solar is about 500 megawatts. So at 1%, you'd be at about 500 megawatts. At 10%, you'd be at 5,000. And I think it's really a call that this body needs to make about, you know, how aggressively do we want to push forward in this area and over what period of time?
Representative Paul.
Sorry.
Representative Scott, one more follow-up?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair. And so in that analysis, will you be also calculating the impact to ratepayers of, you know, you said the 500 is one unit is equal to 500 kilowatts, correct?
Correct. 500 megawatts.
Megawatts, sorry. And so what is that going to cost the average ratepayer? Is that going to be a factor in your decision making?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Representative Portman.
Representative Portman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, the bill that this committee will ultimately consider will have an element of the value of solar and also a solar goal. And those things work together. So looking at one piece of the bill by itself, you can't really analyze the full answer to that question. We'll be looking at the cost and also the funding mechanism for the value of solar as a complete package.
Thank you.
Just one last thing I just wanted to share. Mr.
Representative
Robigo?
Scott, if I let you do another follow-up, Representative Quam is going to be very upset
okay,
with
I just
me.
Really
so.
Quickly.
All right.
Mr. Robigo said that the peaking times matched for solar what demand was here, and I have a chart here that says otherwise. It shows that the peak for solar is, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the peak usage for at least in my area there in Andover, northern suburbs, is somewhere around 7 o'clock at night. So it doesn't exactly match up, and maybe that works differently in Austin, Texas, or other places, but that's the chart that I have for my cooperative.
Mr. Robigo.
Yes, Representative Scott, I'm sorry if I misspoke. I wrote it down, but I might have not said it right. What I said was, or wanted to say, was that it operates most near the time of summer peaks. So it tends to be when you're hotter and you have air conditioning loads, that's you have that coincidence. But that may be not true here. So I that was my experience, and I don't want to represent what your load duration curve is here.
Right. This is right. July 4th.
Representative Scott, please.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Robigo, I heard you said Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act 1978, otherwise known as PURPA, and that always kind of perks my interest. But could you give us a little history on that as to how that came to be and why that law exists and kind of the genesis of it?
Mr. Robigo. A brief history, please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
In 1978, faced with the oil embargo and the country's excessive reliance on petroleum imported from other countries, Congress made a move to try to reduce our petroleum consumption. It's surprisingly, in those days, a fair amount of petroleum was used to operate electricity. One of the biggest items of low-hanging fruit that existed at the time was so-called co-generated energy, which was the ability to take waste heat from chemical and industrial processes and run it through a subsequent turbine to generate electricity. This cogeneration idea was largely ignored by electric utilities who were busy engaged in large power plant construction programs and were not interested in generation that was being provided by some of their larger customers, and that would sort of interfere with the financial plan. So Congress, after a lot of debate, said that they were going to actually require utilities to take energy that was produced by these qualified entities, mostly cogenerators, and at the same time threw in a definition for qualified facilities to provide a similar opportunity for the emerging renewable energy sector. In those days, biomass plants were the big option. It was a short walk from the cogeneration facilities. So that mandate was imposed by the utilities, and actually what happened is through the Federal Power Act, it required utilities to calculate an avoided cost rate, which they would pay for excess avoided and excess energy at the rate that otherwise the utility would have to pay for the next marginal unit of energy generation. And a duty was imposed on the state commissions to make an avoided cost calculation. That facilitated the entering of purchase power agreements with these QFIPPs, Qualified Facilities Independent Power Producers, that kicked off the cogeneration business and was adapted and adopted and adapted in places like California to kickstart the wind industry and eventually the solar energy industry. It's largely been displaced where there are competitive wholesale markets, but every state utility commission that I know of still has an avoided cost methodology, and the Power Act still requires utilities to take power from those facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that history. I really appreciate it. And a question is, PURPA basically said that it was, or part of PURPA's outcome was actually the sale of power back to the utilities. Is that correct?
Yes, and that
Mr.
was
Robigo.
Yes. I'm going to go slower. yes, that was the effect, and it was pretty unprecedented.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this goes to Mr. Grant. Then I just had to take a little bit of the history here of PURPA and why we have net metering, and I have a little bit of concern with part of the bill that basically does away with some net metering, and I think that the comments that was not intended, or we didn't set this up to go and sell back into the marketplace, I think is maybe historically a little bit at odds with what actually happened. So I have some concerns with some of the things that are made to maybe move away from the net metering and avoid moving to avoided costs, because you're really eliminating the financial incentive to actually go and put other facilities on. I understand the value of solar portion, but there are other technologies out there, and I really think that you're going to hinder the businesses and other entities that are trying to develop other qualified facilities if you put the only incentive in there is the avoided cost.
And that was a comment, am I right? Thank you very much, Representative Falk. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just have a comment as well. Members, I just passed out a two-page spread from a fascinating book called Capitalism at Work. I'm focusing on the solar power thing that the Wall Street Journal ran, that's going to meet 20% of our needs. By the year 2000, this was published in 1978. Members, we've been around this block before. I think, quoting a verse in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. That was a pun, Mr. Chairman.
That was a good one.
But it's a great segue, Representative Falk's comment, or a question about what Congress did for cogenerated power. If you read a little bit, this is just completely inadvertently, but a little bit of the pages around here, I'd suggest you get this book and read this chapter, because it further expounds on what Mr. Robigo just talked about, and kind of how we began to address the who had a right to generate power and service a service territory. It's a fascinating discussion about how we began to chip away at that. Whether or not that's a good thing remains to be seen. And this is a fascinating discussion to listen to this because some of us have been around this block before, and I'm having deja vu. But, Mr. Chairman, this is for the committee's edification. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Beard. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Grant, the in the bill we have on, and we're, I assume we're working off the delete all amendment, right? Did we move that or not?
We did it off the DE1, yes.
Thank you. So we have separated out a utility that has nuclear power. We've separated out Xcel for a potentially separate mandate. Why is that?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Garofalo, the current RES sets a different standard for Xcel and an earlier time frame. We simply utilize the same structure, and it would be largely for the same reasons, is that Xcel, as a result of the Prairie Island Agreement, was well ahead of their counterparts in developing renewable energy. It was felt that they could, given the nature of their service territory and the lead that they had on others, achieve a higher standard at a sooner date.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, given the fact that we're willing to separate out Xcel because of their history and to a certain degree their different customer base, is the department willing to separate out rural co-ops and those with a different demographic profile, a declining population base, less industrial customers to establish, instead of a one-size-fits-all approach, if we're willing to separate out for Xcel, are we willing to separate, is the department willing to separate out those rural co-ops on a different standard as well?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Garofalo, clearly we don't, that's not a place where we start with this language. I expect that to be part of the conversation. Clearly, that'll be the author's choice about whether and which of those types of amendments to accept. I'm at least open to that conversation, but we don't have a proposal on the table.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
Sorry, the department's not opposed to the idea, so I'm glad to hear that. My next question, before you answer that.
This is number three, Representative Garofalo.
It is. To the gentleman from Texas, you have a long-standing, you have a lot of work in this area. Explain to us some of the trade-offs with these policies. I mean, obviously, you've done a good job of laying out the assets, the reasons in favor of it. Lay out for us the liabilities and some of the trade-offs with this policy.
Mr. Apago.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. The biggest challenge is change, and it is in a utility industry which is typically relatively slow to adopt change, and because of huge invested underlying assets as well as sort of patterns of behavior. So that's the biggest part. People have to come to terms with understanding that that it's worth going through this analysis in order to reach a fair price for the value of solar, as opposed to the simple act of just allowing it to net against the retail rate. So that's the big part, just everybody getting to understand it. You do have to reprogram your billing system a little bit. It's relatively trivial because we do credits and charges all the time. And in fact, you do, in some ways, it may be simpler, but there is a billing change that has to be undertaken. The utility will have to add a annual additional process of plugging current numbers into the model. Again, it's a spreadsheet model. The numbers usually come from the same processes that are used for fuel factor reconciliation, but it is an additional step. We found that it works best when you are transparent and publish what the number is each year, but some utilities consider the posting of numbers like that, you know, we didn't give them the detail of our gas contracts, but we published the summation number. That's a cultural issue and adds a little bit of work for the public relations people to sort of post their updated numbers and say where they're going. There are some perception issues that have come up in my discussions with people about the value of solar rate. One is the erroneous perception that a solar customer is moving from a stable compensation mechanism to a variable compensation mechanism. The idea being that with net metering, I always know I'm going to get the retail rate, but with value of solar, this thing has changed every year. Of course, rates can change every year, So value, so net metering, the value for your solar changes anytime the utility changes any component of the underlying rate. So it's variable too, but there's this perception that because rates have been relatively stable, there's some added volatility in the value of solar rate. There are, one of the things we found out in Austin is that if you have extremely high rates in tiered rate systems, you can actually get to the point, well, I'll be literal on this. I had one customer write me an email who said they had a 12.6 kilowatt solar system, which is about three or four houses of normal solar, on their house, and they consume 3,500 kilowatt hours a month, which is
a lot.
Three or four houses worth of electricity. And that would have put them in the extremely high tier of electricity rates.
There's a great joke there I can't pass up. I thought you were going to tell us the commissioner was, or the homeowner was very high from growing all the stuff they were with that power.
Please.
Mr. Robigo. There's a history story about solar, but we won't go into that one.
Oh, really? No, please.
Representative Garofalo.
But anyway, I'm sorry. I'll finish to say that customer, because their consumption was so high, would have been, is at a very high tier, and actually gets less for the value of solar than they pay for their underlying consumption. We reached a policy conclusion that that customer should start working on energy efficiency as a priority and not try to solar their way out of their lifestyle. There's some administrative burden. There's a perception of instability. And by the way, I won't go into a long discussion about the regulatory lag and the benefits for the solar customer of lag and how it works in that stuff. But we could have that as a longer discussion if you'd like to. But those are the issues. I guess the one other thing is that one utility remarked that it was subjective and in the eye of the beholder how to value this stuff. And that's because, I guess this is the biggest one. The universe of potential benefits or costs that you could assess for any one kind of resource is practically infinite. I alluded to the fact that we simultaneously in Austin conducted a study at the time we did our value of solar study for the economic development, tax-based, job creation type benefits associated with solar. I will tell you as an ad hoc fact, we came up with about 42 cents worth of benefit for every kilowatt hour of solar using standard economic development multiplier numbers and things like that. But those numbers are pretty soft, so we didn't include them. There is a perception that some of these numbers get high because you include soft numbers. We only use the ones that our energy market operations team was completely comfortable with and erred on the conservative side. But there is that concern that without a bit of discipline in the structure of your algorithm, you will have subjectivity. So getting a good conservative, analytically based algorithm is essential. But again, as Mr. Grant said, that's the benefit over net metering, because the relationship between the approved retail rate and the value of solar is at best coincidental.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Hold on a second, Representative Garofalo. Mr. Robigo, I am dying to know, after all these analytics and inputs and considerations, what value of solar did you arrive at? Let's get to the end of the book.
In Austin, Texas, where the average retail rate was residential rate was about 10 cents, the value of solar calculation came out to about 13 cents.
Thank you.
It is, I tell people this is not analytical, but it's, since we're trying to figure out what a kilowatt hour produced at or near the point of consumption is worth, and the standard we are saying is full retail service plus it's got to be environmentally friendly, right, and come, you know, so it's got to have zero carbon. It's almost like retail plus the value of green power. So if you have a utility that's charging a couple of cents, our differential was 2.7 cents for green power. That's about what happens when you add that to our residential rate. Now, that's just a rule of thumb thing. But deep down in the analysis, it's going to be a couple cents more in today's gas prices. It's heavily driven by the price of gas and by the gas forecast. And as anybody burning gas will tell you, there isn't anything other than some sort of weighted average cost of capital for gas forecast beyond what the market will provide, which is about 5 years. But so it really it depends on where you are in gas prices. Right now it's relatively low. When gas prices were up around $8, our value of solar rate was up around 17 cents. So at half that, it went down to about 12.8 cents, 13, as I said, which reflects sort of the capacity element more heavily, kind of the fixed cost component.
So, Mr. Thank Chairman. You, Mr. Rabago. Representative Groffel, I know this testifier is very valuable to all of us, and he's driven a long, long way.
It's five words, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
You kind of butt in front of me. So.
All right. I did. Chair's prerogative, Representative Groffel.
Well, you're the temporary chair, though, Mr. Chairman. So.
I'm here for now, Representative Groffel. Would That's you like to ask another question? I would call on Representative Yarusa.
Thank you, permanent Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the testimony to this committee, then, is that installing extra solar does not cost more money.
It does not cost the utility more money if you use a correctly calculated value of solar rate than it would cost the utility to produce an equivalent and produce and deliver an equivalent kilowatt hour of energy to the customer. So, you know, we at Austin Energy were trying to do solar energy. We had several options in front of us. We had purchased power from large-scale utility operations that might be remote and would have to be transmitted and distributed. We had local rooftops, municipal solar installations. We had a whole host of ways of deploying this technology because it is, of course, so flexible. What we wanted to do was figure out, like as I said in my testimony, what's the point at which we're exactly, essentially neutral to the customer making it and us giving them credit for it, or for us making a solar or solar equivalent kilowatt hour of energy and delivering it to the same toaster, hair dryer, computer, whatever the end use was.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Groffel. Representative Yarusa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I correct in thinking that would the value of solar be calculated separately for each utility, or would there be one number for the state?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Gray.
And Representative Yarusa, it would be a separate calculation for each utility because the cost elements comprising the value of solar rate will be different for each utility.
So,
Representative Yarusa.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, thank you. So that would take care of the differences among the utilities in terms of what their own local conditions are, what their mix of customers is, and how far their transmissions are and whatnot.
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Yarusa, yes, I would expect that would be the case.
Thank you. And Mr.
Representative Yarusa?
I've got a comment on a previous bit of data. With respect to Representative Scott's data, I think we need to note that the date that you showed that for is July 4th of 2012. And there are two things that would be very highly unusual about that date. We had record high temperatures that week, in which case we would not get as much evening cooling as we often do. And secondly, it's a holiday, so there would not have been businesses open and using air conditioning in the afternoon as there normally would, so it would shift it more in terms of the residential use rather than the business use.
Thank you, Representative Yarusa. Representative Quam, I promised we'd get back to you for another question. We do have other testifiers we need to get to as well, so why don't you wrap things up, Representative Quam.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not a trivial topic we're talking about. The timing and details will have effect across decades, so I think we have to do the due diligence to do the closest to getting it right as we can. And as Representative Beard pointed out, there have been, rotating when was the right time for solar, but I'm glad that I moved out of Texas when I did because I never saw the $8 gas, and so I don't understand that in the calculations. And in Minnesota being different, I wonder sometime when we have testifiers telling us what is the impact of today's weather and yesterday's weather on the solar output. So that would better help us understand Minnesota, how we count it as baseline and how we count it as everyday type of power. But I want to try and better understand this solar value because we're trying to come up with something along that in equivalence, and I see that it's, you know, 30% premium. When I look at the people in greater Minnesota that don't have or probably won't have a lot of this industrial, I have co-ops and utilities that are primarily residential, and a couple things pop up. One is that the average person's income that has the upfront capital put in this the solar generation is quite a bit above the average rate payer. I think one group mentioned that their average household income was $60,000, and I don't think it's fair to impose on the lower income portion that can't afford to install solar a rate premium to cover the 30% up cost for that power, and that's retail, that's not wholesale. And, you know, we have other non-carbon generating things, you know, in wind generation in Minnesota that they can buy for less than this. So I think we need, as we're doing this policy, to keep in mind unintended consequences and maybe try and cap what's paid back in solar. And if we are going to subsidize it because we say we are promoting, you know, solar energy, then let's do that in a much more transparent and straightforward manner with a subsidy from the state than imposing on the local payers. And I wonder if Mr. Rabideau. Sorry about that. Can maybe enlighten the rate impact, the penetration that you saw in your area using this type of approach, and, you know, that impact, and if it was localized to the Austin or if it got into some of the more rural areas of the state, because, you know, obviously you've done some implementation. Let us learn from that and then understand the differences that Minnesota has, such as today's weather.
Thank you, Mr. Rabago. Representative Portman.
I just want to interject. The only financing mechanism the committee's had in front of it on solar so far is a 1.33% charge. In Representative Morgan's bill, there is not a financing mechanism identified in the governor's bill. And so if people are looking for a cap or a cost, the number to keep in mind is the number that was in Representative Morgan's bill, which is 1.33%. And I'll let Mr. Rabago answer as to the Austin experience.
Mr. Rabago.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, there was a lot there, but I will try to answer your last question. What does it cost? If you take that 3 cent uptake, the difference between the value of solar and the average residential rate, and you consider that to be I think you used the word premium, I would argue it's not, because it's what the solar is worth, and we're trying to get some solar into the mix for all the benefits of having clean solar is about. But if you take that 3 cents and you use the average insolation rates, which is kWh per kW, how much solar produces in Texas, which is a little different than you have here, especially on days like today, we're talking about an impact of about $50,000 per megawatt of solar. So for every 1,000 kilowatts of solar, and that's, if you figure four, that's 250 homes, $50,000 per year for that 3 cents, which is embedded in a utility that had revenues between $1 and $1.5 billion. So it is a fraction of cents to basically, for all customers, assuming full recovery of that 3 cents. But remember, the customers pay their rate. But it's a fraction of cents. And for the utility and for our policymakers, it was a decision that we wanted to have a water-free, carbon-free, local-generated generation resource as part of our utility system. That was the policy decision. We're going to go forward with solar, and that was that rough impact. So 50,000 per megawatt in a $1 to $1.5 billion annual revenue utility. And I'm terrible with all those zeros, but it's time.
Representative McQuam, let me just say this. This bill is going to be laid over. We're not voting on this today. Mr. Grant and the chair, Representative Hortman, have indicated a willingness to work with folks on the details and so forth of the bills as we move forward. There are people who are here to testify today. I'd like for us to be sure to hear them, their testimony on this bill, because oftentimes they have good advice for us. And then if we have time at the end of that and we still have some more questions for this testifier who has traveled a long way, we can do that then. Mr. Rabago, will you be available after, or do you have to fly right back to Texas?
Mr. Chairman, I am available until I think my plane is scheduled for after 3 p.m. tomorrow.
So okay.
We can go all night.
Well, careful. Here we take you up on that. So is that okay, Representative Quam, if we move on to testifiers?
With the one clarification that there is inherent in here a revenue source by if the utilities are paying above retail for something, the utilities are guaranteed X amount of, you know, dollars. Basically, that is going to be shuffled to the ratepayers. And I don't see anything here limiting it to a percent. I don't, you know, and if we're going 10%, I know it's dot, 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 but I've heard 10%. That doesn't become just a few cents, you know, in billions. So, you know.
Representative Quam, you have a very good question there. I think Mr. Abago, maybe offline afterwards, or maybe if we have time, we can come back to and answer that question again. I think that'd be much appreciated. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Grant, Representative Hortman. We have Kevin Keene first up on the list, and Jeff Baldridge from Green Range Energy will be on deck. Mr. Keene is here to testify on the bill. Mr. Keene, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and then please let us have your testimony.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Kevin Keene. I am an electrical engineer with Cummins Power Generation in Fridley, Minnesota. I would like to start off by thanking Representative Hortman, as well as the state, Mr. Grant, and the committee for the opportunity to speak today in support of the proposed legislation. As a bit of background from for those of you that aren't familiar with Cummins, we are the largest engine producer in the world, with our power generation headquartered in Shoreview and employing over 2,000 people. At Cummins Power Generation in particular, we provide a $312 million direct impact on the state, and our core business entails the design and manufacture of stationary power equipment, specifically in the range between 3 kilowatts and 3 megawatts, and particularly including cogeneration or combined heat and power, as it's often called. My particular role is to serve as the project director for a collaborative program, research and design, with the United States Department of Energy. We have a collaborative agreement with them under which we are designing and implementing a low-cost packaged combined heat and power system, and it's a specific design project that we started back in 2010. The Department of Energy has actually established a number of different goals associated with combined heat and power, and with the intent of enhancing industrial energy efficiency in general, in domestically, and particularly through investment in small-scale combined heat and power systems, those less than 1 megawatt in size, and is also particularly in light of President Obama's recent executive order regarding industrial energy efficiency and combined heat and power in August of 2012. As a result, Cummins Power Generation has actually partnered with the Department of Energy, and we're currently developing a high-efficiency, low-emissions combined heat and power system that we believe has the capability of enhancing the electrical grid stability and reliability. As a key component of our development agreement, we at Cummins Power Generation are required to provide evidence of system commercialization. Unfortunately, however, given the current utility standby service and peaking policies, systems such as our prototype would provide little economic feasibility in Minnesota, which ultimately limits the commercialization potential and the overall intent of the Department of Energy research objectives that we are currently undertaking. Cummins Power Generation currently supports expansion of the net metering limits as outlined in Section 3 of the proposed legislation and elimination of the standby service fees outlined in Section 8. Increasing the small facility threshold to 1 megawatt would actually serve to enhance the proliferation of combined heat and power systems, as well as distributed generation, such as those mentioned previously in the solar aspects, and would open up some significant opportunities for job growth in the state in manufacture, design, and implementation, including integration of combined heat and power systems. So I just have a very brief statement in conclusion. We attest at Cummins Power that the proposed bill resolves critical issues in addressing Minnesota's energy efficiency and places the state at the forefront for emissions reduction and industrial green technology investment. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be happy to field any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Keene. Can you stay around afterwards for questions?
No problem.
Thank you very much. I'd like to move on to the next testifier, who is Jeff Baldridge from Green Range Energy. And on deck would be Margaret, is it Hodrick? Hodnick from Minnesota Power will be on deck. Mr. Baldridge? Okay. Ms. Hodnick from Minnesota Power. And then on deck will be Bill Black, Larry Johnson, and Deb Bergen from the Municipal Power Agencies will be on deck. Ms. Hodnick, thank you for your time. Please state your name for the record and let us hear your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Margaret Hodnick. I'm Vice President of Regulatory and Legislative Affairs for Minnesota Power, and we appreciate the opportunity to be before you this morning. Minnesota Power believes in encouraging solar technology adoption primarily through incentives, and my comments this morning about the bill have to do primarily with resource planning concerns that we think the bill raises, and that's what we'd like to address. But I wanted to start out by just saying we believe solar technology should be encouraged, but incentives are the primary way that we think that that should be happening. My first comments have to do with the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard. And we've all acknowledged that the standard has been successful. It's been met, and it's been met in a cost-effective way and in a timely way. And the reason it's been successful is because it provides flexibility. It doesn't prescribe what a utility needs to do. It also provides for banking renewable credits that can be utilized over a four-year period, so it gives some flexibility for how the standard is met, recognizing that resources and load come on the system in varying chunks, and that flexibility over time really benefits customers, because if we get ahead of what we need to add to the system, we've got those credits in a bank and they can be accrued to the benefit of customers and used as we need to meet the standard. The standard also allows the market to determine what is the best technology in terms of cost and reliability and fit on a utility system. It doesn't get prescribed by the Renewable Energy Standard. There's a goal to meet, but it doesn't have a lot of prescriptions in it, and that's why it's been successful. We're not in favor of carving up the Renewable Energy Standard and making prescriptions within it for certain types of technologies to be used. That hasn't happened to date, and we've been successful to date, and I think that evidence is very clear that it works to set a standard but not carve it up. We think it would force uneconomic decisions. And I'd like to make a few comments now about why solar hasn't been heavily developed within utility portfolios in Minnesota. And again, rooftop solar, individual customers electing to do that, that's one thing. But forcing it into the Renewable Energy Standard is something I said that concerns us. Minnesota is fortunate to be geographically located close to excellent wind resources, decent biomass resources, and hydro resources. And those are lower costs than solar. And that is the reason why in Minnesota Power's resource planning, we've elected to move in a lot of those types of resources for our customers, because we want to become more renewable, and we are. We're actually ahead of where we need to be. But we want to do it in a way that keeps rates reasonable. None of our customers wants their rates it'd be any higher than they need to be, and that's something we take very seriously. We also are able to do creative and innovative things with these resources. For example, we have a lot of wind generation. We're able to pair it with hydro generation that we're bringing in and use those together because we know wind, for example, is not available 24 hours a day, and so we're able to match that up with hydro on our system, and we have the creativity and the flexibility within the renewable energy standard to do things like that. So the idea of prescriptions and of having to have a certain amount of any type of particular energy within our supply, we think works to a disadvantage for our customers as a whole. Solar makes sense in the Southwest and on the East Coast where there are resources and high rates, for example, that make it applicable. It doesn't fit as well in Minnesota in a utility prescriptive resource planning sense. We've supported solar through our Solar Sense program and our conservation program resources. We've got solar projects in our service territory, including the Mulaski Stadium at UMD, the Hartley Nature Center, and the Duluth Zoo. So we have installations of solar, and we'd like to have more of those. But again, when it comes to prescribing it within the renewable, within the resource standard and the renewable energy supply, we're not in favor of that. Utility-scale solar, if we were to build a big solar project and put on our system, it's 3 to 6 times the cost of other like wind resources that we could add. And small-scale solar, the smaller projects that would be, let's say, on a customer home, would be 6 to 10 times as expensive. And our customers are very concerned about their rates. As I said, we hear about their rates from them, and I know we hear about other utilities' rates. There's stories in the media about those from time to time. And so rates do matter to people. And we would be adding solar if we thought it was cost-effective in terms of our resource resource mix that way.
Ms. Hodnick, can we move along here? We're trying to get some more people in, and we still have one more bill to do today.
Sure.
So thank you very much.
I guess my last point is that solar is an intermittent resource. Utilities can't defer investment in critical infrastructure like substations and feeders and distribution lines because of solar being added to the system. And if there was any type of a solar rate that was established, we think it needs to honestly account for what impacts it would really create on the system. And again, as we've calculated, solar would cost 6 to 10 times on a small scale next to other renewable resources that we could provide. So appreciate your consideration and listening to me this morning about our concerns about solar, and we look forward to further conversations.
Thank you, Ms. Hodnick. Will you be available after the committee meeting if people have questions?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your coming down. Bill Black, Larry Johnson, and Deb Bergen are next, and then Joel Johnson, I believe, from the REA will be after that. We have about 10 minutes left for testimony and closing comments before we lay it over. So we have two groups on the list. So if you can take 3 or 4 minutes, that'd be great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, 3 or 4 minutes for our group?
Yes, yeah, and then 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll be wrapping things up and moving on to the last bill. Thank you very much. Please state your name for the record and let us hear your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Black. I'm with Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I'll be very brief if that's all the time we have. MMUA cannot support the bill being heard as it is introduced and amended with the DE amendment because of potentially devastating effects on smaller utilities that are our members, and also no way of knowing the effects on all the other utilities. We are familiar with the effects on all the other utilities. We are familiar with the value of solar as it's been presented. We've been looking at it for over a month now as well. Although it's only been in place in Austin since November, I believe, this bill would make it the law of the land for the state of Minnesota, and we have a lot of misgivings about going forward at this point. I was here before saying that Austin, Texas is different than Minnesota, and I stand by that. I think it's different than Grand Marais and Ely and North Branch and Blooming Prairie for a lot of reasons that aren't incorporated in this legislation that really need to be looked at. The net metered systems, the 1,000 megawatts at avoided cost, still creates a lot of problems on municipal systems, smaller use systems. The value of solar leaves a lot of uncovered costs and a lot of uncertainty about how the formula would actually be in place. The process for getting to that, the stakeholder group, leaves us with a lot of misgivings about how that formula is going to be developed and whether it would be applicable to us. And we think we should look at the other states that have done solar net metering. Of the 14 that have large 1 megawatt or so caps, 11 of them exempt municipal utilities. And that's something to seriously consider for the reasons that they have exempted. And the ones that do allow it, California, Maryland, New Hampshire, have stronger protections for the smaller ones than this proposal does. With that, I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Who's next? Ms. Bergen?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the bill. Given the time, I'm going to condense my remarks to just two critical points that I want to make sure that we touch base on in the bill. One is with regard to the third-party ownership. I might suggest to you that I'm sure that was intended to provide additional flexibility for customers to be able to find a way to install and get these things put in place. But this is kind of a slippery slope that we've been down the road on before in Minnesota and frankly rejected. Those of you who were around for the debates as it related to retail wheeling know that there were a number of proposals at that point in time that were introduced with the idea of allowing retail wheeling for renewable power. We actually debated those things, and they were turned down. Again, I'm sure it was with the idea of trying to provide, you know, maybe some jobs and some nice community-based organization that could do these sorts of projects. It could just as easily be Solar USA. It could just as easily be Goldman Sachs. At the end of the day, there could be, you know, thousands of megawatts put on the grid with companies that have no relationship to the PUC, that have no relationship to MISO, that have no relationship to NERC. And we would caution, we think that's a piece that shouldn't move forward. And very quickly in closing, because I want to give the department credit. In the 18 months that they spent doing this, frankly, I was one of those guys that Bill talked about being very excited about the buy-all, sell-all concept and the value of solar. And I was extremely ecstatic about the concept until the amendment was introduced. And you may want to know why I would now say that. And the reason I would say that is because it now has a sub-E in that, which at lines 2.10 say that in no case shall the commission or governing body approve an alternative tariff rate where the value-based credit is lower than the appreciable retail rate. I think you just heard Mr. Robideau suggest that if there's a correlation between those two things, it is purely coincidental. You know, we're not really in a position right now without the algorithms in place to be able to tell you exactly what we think that might be. On our system currently, we might suggest to you that we think that number might, in fact, be between 5 and 6 cents. You know, so a much different number than people are maybe hearing about. Bears a lot of relationship to what's going on. I don't purport to be an expert on ERCOT. They're kind of a separate universe all in themselves. But here in MISO land, when we start taking a look at some of those things, I think there could be some significant differences there. So we understand that that's not going to provide the sort of incentive that will drive to the goals that many of these bills are approaching, which is why we recognize that there's the REPI bills out there, there's the Made in Minnesota bills that are out there. We understand that. We understand why that would do that and why those would go forward. We just think that ought to be discussed in a transparent sort of environment as well. From our members' standpoint, you know, we don't win by gaining the relationship between what we pay customers for their value of solar. On our systems, the customers are the same ones that own the system. And we just want to make sure that we're fair on that. If we get charged something from MISO, we want to recover that. If MISO gives us a 30% credit for capacity, then that's what we would give there. We recognize when we look at this that this is during on-peak periods. We would look to do that sort of a thing. But, you know, this is the sort of thing that the devil is truly in the details on this. And I guess we would urge you to slow that process down. We appreciate that Madam Chair and the administration have looked to lay this over, but we think this algorithm is at the heart of doing some very good things in terms of distributed generation. We'd like to get it right. That's the sort of thing maybe we think might make some sense to polish out between sessions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Bergen.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I had 3 pages of testimony and notes, but, you know, I think I might shorten it and go off notes.
Thank you, Ms. Bergen.
You're welcome. When we talk about net metering the value of solar, I think we have 2 interests that must be priority. One is the one that Mr. Grant stated. These should not be for revenue generations for the individual owners. Because when it's a revenue generator, it violates the second thing I'm going to say that should be priority. Other customers on the system should not have cost shifted to them. It should not be their burden. And therefore, I will echo Mr. Black and Mr. Johnston in saying with the 1 megawatt net metering, at the very least, that should be limited to the customer sizing it to load so they limit the amount of generation into the system. Because when you generate into the system, then it becomes a revenue generator for you. And then the cost to the distribution system, the backup power, the administration falls on all the other customers, particularly when you're not charging standby fees. With the value of solar as well as Mr. Johnston stated, when you elevate the cost to retail rate and you're talking about promoting this to generate into the system, then again it becomes a revenue generator for that individual customer. And who pays for that? All the other customers. And that's something we want to avoid, and we think that's a priority. One more thing I will bring up. I talked to Mr. Grant about this briefly last week. It might just be an MRAS particular issue. With MRAS's contracts, when you do distributed generation, the interconnection is with our individual members, but the power supply is purchased by MRAS, a wholesale supplier, so we may have some different legal issues with PURPA, and I hope to work with Mr. Grant to continue on that so that we don't come crosshairs.
Thank you very much for your testimony today, all 3 of you. Thank you. Mr. Johnson from Rural Electric Association. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joel Johnson with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. I don't think it's going to surprise anyone on the committee that our members have a number of grave concerns with the bill. With that said, however, we do appreciate the efforts of the administration to look into addressing the concerns that we've been talking with them over the past 18 months about the current net metering laws and the way that the current law allows customers who self-generate can often completely avoid paying for any of the infrastructure costs that they use when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. And that's been our main concern over the past 18 months of getting some way to address that in current law. While we do believe that the value of solar talks could produce a system that we could support, there is so much uncertainty right now with the algorithm, how that's going to be calculated, that we have real struggles moving forward, particularly with the other changes to the net metering laws that are included in the bill. Again, like the munis, we have real concerns about lifting the current 40 kW cap all the way up to 1 megawatt. I think in many of the previous discussions we've had in the legislature, we've focused solely on the retail payments. But in our discussions over the past 18 months, where the real cost shifting occurs is when net metered customers don't pay for the infrastructure. And without being able to, this bill specifically forbids utility from charging standby fees. That is going to be a real problem, particularly on smaller systems, if they get one of their larger customers who are completely netting out their energy use. Because if we're going under the current net metering laws, most of the infrastructure costs will remain embedded in the rate that's paid for electricity. We have a number of other bills. Most have been discussed fully, but we are interested in talking with the author and members of the committee, looking for a way forward on this. But we remain and have grave concerns and cannot support the bill in its current form. Thank you, and I can answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. You'll be available after committee if people have questions. We're going to be recessing and coming back later tonight. I think Madam chair. As Representative Garofalo has pointed out, you are the permanent chair. I am but the temporary chair. Later on tonight, we will be dealing with an additional bill and maybe more questions later on. So thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Portman, you have returned to the front table. I'm assuming that what we will do right now is renew your motion to lay over House File 956 as amended for possible inclusion in a committee bill. So, thank you.
Now, Representative Atkins needs only 5 minutes to present his bill, I'm told. So we have reserved a full 7 minutes for Representative Atkins' bill. I move that House File 854 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Energy Omnibus Bill. Members, on Monday the 11th, we are going to be voting on a number of individual bills. You'll be getting the notice soon about what the bills will be. We'll be voting on a lot of bills on Monday. We'll be laying some over. This is one that we will be voting on Monday, but we are not voting on it today. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I pride myself on only carrying non-controversial bills, and this truly is one of them. I give a great deal of credit to the proponents for reaching out to potential opponents and discussing their concerns ahead of time. I'm not aware of any opposition. The point of the bill is that it increases the amount of public utility that provides natural gas must spend on its conservation improvement program, which is currently 0.02%, would increase it to 0.04%. Normally, that doubling might be perceived as somewhat onerous. The fact is all of the utilities are, in fact, already providing 0.04% or better, in some cases as much as three or four times what's currently required. The aim of this bill is simply to establish that in law so that there's that expectation moving forward. People can rely on it, know that it's going to be there. And they've even built in a provision, the proponents working with the utilities, to make sure that there would be no disincentive or penalty for utilities that do even better than that. And with that, Madam Chair, that's my 45 seconds. I do have a testifier and then would look forward to hearing from anyone who might have questions.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just a couple of points I'd like to my name is Pam Marshall with the Energy Sense Coalition. I did want to let committee members know that we, our organization, part of the work we do is to administer the current low-income conservation improvement program for both Xcel Gas and Electric, and that we're, for the last couple years, we've been working with CenterPoint to develop a low-income rental conservation improvement program. And all I want to do today is to just point out, beyond the obvious energy conservation benefits that these programs entail, that there are additional societal benefits that aren't counted when we evaluate those programs. And those benefits include making energy bills more affordable to low-income people on an ongoing basis. They include improving and stabilizing low-income housing for the equivalent of a very modest investment. We're replacing water heaters and furnaces and adding insulation to attics and walls. And I also just wanted to say that I think this is the existing level of spending. It's an equitable one. It's a modest one. And the bill simply sets that level at basically the level that is being invested now. And so I would urge your support as well, and I'm here for questions too.
Thank you, Representative Atkins and Ms. Marshall. Is anybody here to testify in favor of or opposed to House File 854 today? Any questions from members? If not, then we'll lay any closing comments you want to make, Representative Atkins?
Madam Chair, I ain't going to mess it up.
Okay. We'll lay over House File 854 for possible inclusion. And with that, I think the business before the committee today is concluded. We are going to be in recess. We're going to reconvene at 6 p.m. in 118 of the Capitol, and we are going to hear House File 955, my bill that pertains to changing the net metering cap. And hopefully that won't go very long this evening. Representative Morgan, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes, or should we do those at 6 o'clock? We'll do the minutes at 6 o'clock. Members, we're in recess.
I'm ready.
The hour of 6 o'clock having arrived, I will reconvene the Energy Policy Committee. We have one item left on our agenda today. Representative Hortman, you have another bill. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Hortman?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move that House File 955 be recommended be laid over and included in the Energy Policy Bill. However, we are going to vote on it as a single bill on Monday, along with others that we notice at that time. And I do have two amendments.
Would you like to move your amendments, Representative Hortman?
I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
The A2. Now, I have a note here, Representative Hortman, that the A2 amendment appears to be an amendment to House File 956, but it really is an amendment to House File 955. Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, exactly. For some reason, this got titled 956, which was the bill we took care of earlier today. But as you can see on line 1.1, it moves to amend House File 955, and all the changes in it are drafted to 955. So it's only the title in the upper right-hand corner of the sheet that is in error.
Are members clear on this? We're going to call it a computer error, Mr. Eliff.
Thank you.
Yes. Are members clear on this amendment? Are there any questions? Representative Hortman, is there anything you'd like to explain about the amendment?
Why don't we put it on and then I'll explain it.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hortman.
Thank you. I have another amendment. This one did not make the 24-hour rule, so we don't need to move on it if people don't want to, but I just think it would be better if we have the right engrossment of this bill when we deal with it individually on Monday. So I would hope that people would be willing to add the A1 amendment. And it's my understanding that this is a piece we had intended to include in the A2 amendment. It got overlooked in the drafting, and so that's why the A1 is an amendment to the A2.
Representative Hortman, I guess I will ask the lead minority member, Representative Quam, at this moment to see if he has any concerns about this exception to the rule for this purpose. Representative Quam, any comments or concerns?
I would accede to the author's desire to have it in the form of she so desires.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. So, Representative Hortman, correct me if I'm wrong, are we...
It's an amendment to the amendment.
Mr. Eliff, would you please explain what we're doing here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. H0955A1 is actually an amendment to the amendment that we just adopted, as shown in line 1.1.
Mr. Eliff, I would like to do this right. Do we need to reconsider what we just did, amend the amendment first, and then put the A2 amendment on? What's kosher here?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Eliff, I think if we adopt the A1, we're fine because we're just amending language that we just added to the bill.
Does that make sense?
I could be wrong,
Mr.
about
Eliff?
That.
My only concern is that the pages and lines are drawn to the A2 amendment. So I think it probably would be proper to...
Let's back it out, Representative Hortman.
Okay. Back it out.
Okay. Representative Hortman, I believe we need to move to reconsider your motion on the A2 amendment. All those in favor of Representative Hortman's motion to reconsider the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion prevails. We are on reconsideration of the A2 amendment. Representative Hortman, would you like to move the amendment to your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment to the A2 amendment.
Representative Hortman, with the approval of the minority lead at the table, would move the A1 amendment to her amendment. All those in favor of amending the A2 amendment with the... Sorry, Representative Quam.
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair. I had one clarification. The energy storage device, it's in megawatts. I thought that there was a time period in with these devices, you know, megawatt hours.
A measure of hour of energy and not power is what you're saying.
Correct.
That's a good question. Mr. Eliff, do you have a Is this a technical issue that...
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the megawatts refers to the capacity of the energy storage device.
Representative Quam, I think you and I, with
you,
our
Mr.
backgrounds,
Chair,
have the same concern here, but maybe we can resolve this.
I believe that I'm fine with it being brought to attention and a technical correction.
Maybe we can make that later if needs
yes.
be. Okay. Thank you, Representative Quam. Good. Any other questions about the A1 amendment?
Good to have physics majors on the committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Hortman moves the A1 amendment to her A2 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. We are back on the A2 amendment as amended. All those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have the A2 amendment as amended adopted onto the bill. Wow, that was fun. All right. Representative Hortman, I believe your bill is in the order you would like, and would you like to tell us about your bill?
It is, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 955 deals solely with the net metering issue. The first part of the bill before we added the amendments I had drawn up because it seems that there is very wide consensus that the current net metering limit is too small at 40 kilowatt hours. And so I thought that it important that we consider the policy by itself in terms of increasing from the 40 kilowatt limit to 1 megawatt. After I had the bill drafted, I was approached by Lisa
Daniels
from Windustry, and she had some suggestions about how to improve the bill, and I will have her explain the other provisions that we just added.
Thank you very much, Representative Hortman. Ms. Daniels, please introduce yourself and let's hear your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Lisa Daniels. I'm the Executive Director of Windustry. Windustry is a nonprofit based in Minneapolis, but we work throughout the U.S. to promote community wind, where there's more elements of local ownership, local involvement, and local investment in the wind energy development that occurs. And this is primarily to increase the economic development and to keep the economic benefits as local as possible from the wind development. Industry has a long history. We've worked for several years with the U.S. Department of Energy and with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory out of Golden, Colorado on an initiative that they called Wind Powering America. We've just completed one of our last contracts with them, and so we've been around the block a little bit and looked at many different wind energy business models, and we're always open to ideas and trying to diversify how wind projects get deployed so that there can be new opportunity. And the opportunity that we're usually looking out for is to increase local community or local participation in those projects. There's two amendments on here about business models. One is aggregating the meters, and that is just similar to what we heard in the administration bill HF 956. It was in that bill, it was written only for solar, so we have adapted that as a business model that can also work for wind energy. Also, there is the third-party ownership business model, and we have adapted that to work for wind energy as well here. So that is what those two amendments are about. It's just broadening the administration's scope of the business models that they highlighted in their 956 that was heard earlier today. The other piece that we have added into this amendment or set of amendments is something so that there can be public facilities and public buildings that put wind projects, deploy wind projects at a likely site in rural Minnesota. For instance, most rural cities or rural regional centers have wastewater treatment plants. Wastewater treatment plants are an example of a high energy use, and it's a 24/7 load, and they're usually away from densely populated areas.
Thank goodness.
So it just seems like it's a perfect matchup. So we're just looking to put together a piece of a business model that could be adapted by wastewater treatment plants, and we could have cities across Minnesota put these wind turbines in and have them power the wastewater treatment plants or whatever other facilities or buildings they see fit, and have this be something that is a asset for the community, and have it be economic, economically deployed. And that's merely what we're thinking here.
Thank you, Ms. Daniels. Thank you very much. Representative Fortman, do you have something you want to add?
No, point? I imagine there might be people who want to testify against the bill.
Okay.
I don't know. I haven't heard from anybody. But
Are there any quick questions before we move on to testifiers? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam Chair, you made a comment in your opening remarks that you talked to a lot of people who seemed to think that our 40 megawatts was too little. I must move in different circles than you, because most people I talked to said, can we do away with this altogether, particularly in municipal and cooperative adventures in rural Minnesota. There's a long list of reasons, Madam Chair, if you want to take time to go through them now, as to why in the world this is actually a very unfair thing to people who don't put solar panels up or put windmills on the farm. But I, the hue and cry for a million megawatt or a megawatt or 2 megawatts, actually, I had heard, only comes from one source, and that's people who are looking for a mandate or a subsidy to get into the power generation business. So I heard that, and I just wanted you to know I heard something differently. At some point, I'd like to hear your vision for the future, because you mentioned that the other day, and I'm interested to know how all these little pieces comport with that. But I'm struggling with this, why this is good business practice and why this is good for the power grid in this state. Making electricity is a very highly skilled and very precise business. It looks like we're encouraging all kinds of people get into it. For what reason, I don't know, except I heard Ms. Daniels talk about community benefits and the ability, apparently, for everybody to profitable from this. Must be, I guess we must assume it's a wildly profitable business. And I would suggest to you it's not. It's very capital intensive. It's very precise. It's very it's very big and intense, and people do this in a large scale because it makes sense. The margins that are there are shared willfully through the communities, mostly through something that in America we call stock. Communities can benefit by buying stock in any one of their companies. And in fact, I think most of the teachers who retire in our communities and firefighters and police are vested very heavily in utility stock, and this is starting to threaten utility stock. So you'll understand why I'm starting to get just a little concerned, a little cranky about all this stuff. Madam Chair, I just have to throw that out there. I'm looking at this and thinking, okay, this was kind of fun to get an experiment going, but now we're going to go to a megawatt? That's a very large windmill in somebody's backyard. And I can't even fathom how many solar panels, a megawatt worth of solar panels is, but I bet it wouldn't fit on my house in Shakopee. Help me understand why this is a vision I should buy into and vote yes on.
Representative Hortman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, I think the principle that you and I probably share that drives me to introduce this legislation is the belief in a free market capitalist society. And we have a monopoly in the situation of energy provision in this country. And we have had a long-standing monopoly because it's destructive for consumers to have duplicative capital infrastructures. And because of the nature of the growth in the energy industry and the way that we've provided energy in this country. But technology is changing. And so we can be more free market in this area as we move forward. It's our job as policymakers to balance the interests of the regulated monopoly with the interests of consumers and to try to have competition and free market capitalism in the context of this monopoly in a way that's not destructive to the monopoly because we all depend on that monopoly being successful and being secure and reliable and affordable. So I think you and I might pick a different balance between where we give the monopoly complete power and control and where we allow competition. I'm, ironically, in this situation, in favor of more competition than you are. And that's the principle that drives me to bring these kind of bills forward at this point.
Representative Beard.
At the risk of scaring my investor-owned utility friends to death, Madam Chair, I'm with you on the competition. The problem is we haven't quite figured out how to get there. There's the Pennsylvania model, the California model, which we should be fleeing from, by the way, I might add, and some other things. But we should have a fascinating discussion about that someday over coffee about our thoughts on how competition would actually look in a truly free market. If I can just make a few comments on this, something you mentioned, the duplicative capital structures is one thing that's driven me crazy on this committee for 11 years. Because my friends in the wind industry will look at me and say, we need to have this, give us alternative, whatever, you know, community-based benefits and all this other stuff. But it is absolutely a duplicative effort of what's already there. Wind does not work without having an entire system standing idly by waiting for the wind to stop blowing. Or at 6:04, the sun went down. So now we're talking about solar panels. We have to have a completely duplicative system standing idly by waiting for the sun to not shine. It's kind of fun that we can experiment with these things. And don't get me wrong, the technology has changed since my 1978 article I handed out earlier today, but not that much. And what really hasn't changed is that we're still not dealing with a free market. We're looking at not people just investing their own capital to make this work, but we're also looking then at finding a revenue stream to subsidize me putting my panels on my roof and then making my neighbors buy my power at a subsidized rate as well, or an inflated rate that somebody decides is the value of solar members. And so I'm thinking about all these things while you put this forward, and I have a hunch, I'm sorry I missed your opening motion, that this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion, is that right?
That's right, but it will be voted on as an individual bill on Monday with a bunch of others. We'll do what we do often around here and send people's bills alone and send them in the energy omnibus bill. Okay. The desire would be to mostly move one piece of legislation, but you know sometimes committee bills don't make it to the finish line. So some people would like their individual bills to be on the general register, and I'm in that category.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for letting me just make a few comments here. This is a nice, informal, intimate setting, and I just wanted to get that off my chest. That when I first got here, wrestling with a regulated industry just really clashed with my free market sensibilities. It still does in some ways, but nonetheless, in the bigger picture, members, I just encourage us to go cautiously and go slowly before we start tearing off chunks that are bigger than 40 kW, because what I'm hearing is something other than that. So thank you.
Representative Beard, you're welcome. I always value your perspective, as I think this committee does. Representative, let's see, are there any other questions from committee members before we go to testimony? Are there testifiers who are here who would like to speak for or against the bill? Everybody said their piece earlier today, it looks like. Any
all waiting to take us to dinner, I
think. now representative, you know that
I
can't
say
happen.
That all
without any testifiers, then representative, I'm sorry, am I missing somebody? Representative Quam. Yes.
Thank you. I was going to wait till after the testifiers.
Looks like that's now.
And Mr. Chair, clarification, since there would be this bill will be on the agenda for Monday, then the deadline for several amendments that I might bring forward would be
That would be Friday, I believe. 24 hours would be Friday at noon.
Tuesday.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Representative Kwan. Yes, Representative Kwan.
I did have a few clarifying questions. One, Mr. Chair, and the appropriate person could respond that in the A2 amendment on page 2, line 2, 3, and 5, there's a striking of no person shall be deemed to be a public utility. Therefore, if, you know, the implication here is that the owner of a apartment complex or a trailer park facility or manufactured home, however you want to refer to it, or another entity decided to put in sufficient power to generate for that, you know, complex or entity, since you take out this language, do we therefore have that person fall under some of the requirements, definitions, and restrictions and regulations of a public utility?
Mr. Eliff, maybe you can address that
Thank
question.
You, Mr. Chair. I think what Representative Kwan is referring to is just the fact that we had a break between page 1 and page 2 where we did. If you look at the last line on page 1, line 1.25, it created a new paragraph C with language that existed in the statute. No person shall be deemed to be a public utility. What I did on the top of page 2 essentially was clean up the language because that phrase had been repeated 3 times and I didn't want to repeat it a fourth for clause 4. So, but that applies to all 4 clauses.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Eliff. Is that to answer your question, Representative Kwan?
That does take care of that one. Thank you for clarifying. And Mr. Chair, when would we have the, I guess we wouldn't have an engrossment, so we haven't moved it out, but when would we have a clean version since we have a couple of amendments and that might be easier for us to work with?
That's a good question, Representative Kwan. We are laying this bill over, so we are not voting on it, which means I don't believe it will get engrossed until it gets voted on. Isn't that correct, Mr. Eliff?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct. House Research can provide what is called a very unofficial engrossment, which I think would help all committee members in preparing amendments for next week. And I will try my best to get that to folks by the end of tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Eliff. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now to something a little bit more substantive and technical in this. If we do go to a 1 megawatt and you have a cluster of people in a location that decide to install 1 megawatt facilities and they happen to be at the end of a grid distribution from a substation, I have discussed with several people in the utilities and different people that there is a possibility of requiring or needing to either move a substation, build a new substation, or upgrade the grid in that area, because in a off consumption peak, if you have several megawatts produced, you could cause an overload or issue with that grid. And I'm wondering, I'm not seeing in this legislation anything to take care of the cost assessment or special tariff for such a move or installation of support equipment.
Representative Portman?
There is no such provision.
Representative Kwan?
Thank you. The other question I have is there anywhere, and this would probably be staff, anywhere that would give us a hint, or would this be sort of something missing from statute and there wouldn't be a process to assign who would pay for it, so that it would just fall upon the utility ratepayers to cover this?
Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it's my understanding that there are rules in place for interconnection, for example, including who pays for what parts of interconnections, and I believe those would apply to these kinds of facilities as well.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then is it possible that the staff could provide us before we do final passage on Monday, what those are so that we can understand if we need to, with adding all of this extra capability for wind and the net metering that would fit in and make sure that we don't have any unintended consequences?
It's a good question, Representative Quam. I don't know,
Mr. Chair,
what staff can do. Representative Horman.
Perhaps if someone in house research could provide us with the relevant site to the Minnesota rules, we could individually look those up ourselves and read what we thought was relevant to be prepared for Monday's committee.
To perhaps help people with preparing amendments or the sort? Representative Horman?
Well, Mr. Chair, there's a whole complex rulemaking process if people didn't like what's in the rules, but it would provide them context to understand the system that's already in place that deals with the interconnection standards that we're not disrupting.
Thank you for that suggestion, Representative Horman. Ms. Daniels.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's also a statute on the books and a process that was gone through in the mid to early 2000s. It's called DG, or Distributed Generation Interconnection Standards, and it's for anything 10 megawatts and under in the state of Minnesota. And it was, there was a whole process to set up what the standards were for projects 10 megawatts and under.
And Representative Portman, you'd suggest that members who have a particular concern about this could address this to House Research and their able minds for advice.
Mr. Chair, also the Legislative Reference Library is really fantastic. And if you go up and just in the very entryway, there's librarians there and tell them your specific question, they actually turn around research requests in a matter of hours.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Quam, how does that sound?
Well, I'd hope that the entire committee would be able to leverage some capability, and that way we don't accidentally miss some of the interweaving, and I think that's part of the reason why we at each meeting have an experienced staff person that sees that. But any assistance in information would be quite useful. And then going on to the next point is that when I grew up, I remember there being a lot of flickering and power outages, and we improved our systems that, if you had something blow out, you have some pretty quick automatic systems that will redirect and control the power. However, those systems are based off of a known fixed generation and sourcing and routing of power, and I was wondering if, going up to this 1 megawatt, now you are at a level to where you could have some effect to the actions of that. I was wondering if there's been any sort of a study or information as to what the possible unintended consequences when we do have our thunderstorms in the summer, or somebody accidentally hits a pole or a substation, or those type of things happen, and so I'd like to understand what effect the grid and the customers would be by this unplanned, because it's an organic growth as opposed to a planned progressive expansion, what that implication might be, so that we can again see if we need additional sections or verbiage in here, or need to have the PUC do a survey or research of this before we go ahead and introduce this organic growth into our system.
Representative Quam, thank you. Mr. Elock, do you have a...
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I'm recalling that in Representative Morgan's House File 773, there is a section calling for a study, calling for on the utilities to advise the Commission of the distribution points on its system and how much available capacity there is for attaching distributed generation at various places on its system, as well as an estimate of the cost of upgrading that would be needed to make more capacity available. It certainly sounds like that the results of that study would be something that you would be interested in.
Thank you, Mr. Elough.
To that point,
Representative Beard.
There is a distributed generation study that we did a couple years ago that talked about 25 megawatts or under and identified several locations, I believe, Mr. Elough, were you here for that?
Yes, Mr. Elough. Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, yes. Actually, there were two distributed generation studies done looking at, I think, where we could be most easily placed. I believe it was 600 megawatts at the time.
And dispersed in small pieces.
Representative yes. Beard. And Mr. Elough, Representative Beard, do you think that's available in the Legislative Reference Library?
I'm sure it is.
So that might be a good place for a little homework research, huh? I believe that. I believe that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hortman.
There's already a process in place where people can add 1 megawatt projects to the grid. The issue here is making the net metering available to them. One example would be the solar installation at the IKEA store in Bloomington. So these things are already happening. There's already rules in place that govern the whole interconnection process. And what we're just talking about is changing whether or not they are eligible for net metering.
Thank you, Representative Hortman. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, hearing the testifiers, comments about this being, for the wind being a great expansion and capability for municipalities and other entities to do this, I was under the impression that this bill would cause maybe an unanticipated growth, and looking at the other bills, I didn't think, other than there was a 5% proposed in one of them, but there was not really a limit as to who and where the people could add. And I think, and I've been to some of the off, in between session DG conferences, and the impression I had is they were aimed more towards larger, wind farms and as opposed to this, which is a 25x increase in the limit for these. Before were more or less considered individual, facilities, not a commercial farm or a large industrial entity. So I would like to see that material and review it, but I again think that, as the testimony was indicating, this is a big step forward. I would say that maybe 4 years ago, 6 years ago, they maybe did not envision, the 1 megawatt for this type of application, and that's just part of my concern. I want to avoid an unintended consequence.
And I think I appreciate that. I think Representative Hortman appreciates that. Representative Quam, I don't know that there would be an unintended consequence, but I think that your concerns might spark a little initiative to go do a little look up and see. And if you find something, please bring it back to us or email us, and we can take a look at it before committee next Monday as well. Appreciate that. Other members, without further comment, Representative Hortman, final comments?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to lay it over for a possible inclusion.
Representative Hortman, then House File 955, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion, and we will, as the representative suggests, vote on it on Monday to send it onto the General Register, correct?
That's correct. Mr. Chair and members, this is also the room we will be in on Friday. So if people like the way it's laid out, that's good to know, because we will be here on Friday from 9 to noon listening to Representative Hornstein's bill,
Thank
House
you.
File 880. And that one we will also be laying over for possible inclusion. So the next time we'll see each other will be in this room on Friday at 9 in the morning.
So House File 955 as amended is laid over. And we will see everybody at 9 o'clock Friday morning in this very room. And the meeting is adjourned.